What's up, guys? Welcome to the Hypertrophy Cast. My name is Luis Frielingsdorf. I'm the podcast host. And yeah, this is another English episode because today we are joined by Dr. Mike Isretel. I think he doesn't need a further introduction. Mike, so glad you took the time today. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great, man. Thanks for having me on.
Awesome, man. I'm really looking forward to our discussion because what I like about you is that you like to give recommendations based on optimality. And I really enjoy that, listening to you. And I think it's a great way of giving recommendations because people can always take that piece of information and just make calculated trade-offs from there. That's what I do.
That's a really good way of putting it. That's exactly my intention.
Yeah, awesome, man. And currently, you already told me that you're dieting. But what's your kind of overall plan for the next couple of years in terms of your bodybuilding goals, any specific competitions planned? So what are you currently onto?
No specific competitions planned, but I'm hopefully the goal with this present cut is quite long. I think it's going to be about 20 weeks in total. The goal is to get like really, 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 really lean. And hopefully, if that happens, I'll compete in bodybuilding, and then hopefully it all works out, and I will continue to compete quite regularly several times a year in bodybuilding over the next 5 years, see how well I can do and how lean I can look.
Awesome, man. That's going to be exciting, man, to see you on stage. I mean,
I hope so.
A lot of people. Yeah, for sure. Okay, the first topic I kind of want to touch on with you is like macrocycle periodization. I think a progressive overload is a well-established training principle by now, and I guess most people are familiar with the idea that the ability to make things harder is more of a result of productive training than a necessity to make progress. And during a hypercaloric macrocycle, which you try to make every mesocycle harder on average than the previous, and if yes, is this something you want to force by adding additional sets, or do you let it kind of happen naturally by increased training load due to previous adaptations and maybe some improved movement quality?
So there's a time for letting autoregulatory measures dictate your training load additions, whether you measure that by volume or how much weight you're using or proximity to failure, so on and so forth. But I think there are also times when feed forward strategies are necessary, and applying progressive overload programmatically top down is a good idea. I can think of one very good example of the need for progressive overload to be forward looking, not just autoregulated. It is in the context of becoming increasingly very strong at very systemically demanding lifts. So if you squat 50 kilos one day, you come back and you do several other leg exercises that week. Next week you come back and you squat to a certain RIR, RPE, or whatever. It may very well be easy for you to infer that 55 kilos is what you should be doing, or you just get more reps than you have before. And then it's easy to have progressive overload result in an autoregulatory fashion. You get stronger, you feel better, you can do more, and you do more. Same idea if you're progressing in repetitions. So last week you did 12 reps with 50 kilos, this week it's 50 kilos again. And you know, at 12 reps, you hit 12 and you're like, this is so easy, I can do more. You do 13, and the next week 14, and so on and so forth. When you become more advanced in your training becomes harder from a systemic perspective. Like, it's just harder to train because you're better at it now, but you have to tap into more of your psychological resources in order to train hard. So just training quote unquote hard and seeing and increasing the magnitude of difficulty in an autoregulated fashion as you progress may be a little bit more difficult because it's very easy to become complacent. You put 200 kilos on the bar instead of 50, and you do a set of 10. You know, week one and week two, what you feel like doing could be very largely psychological because it's so hard. There's a stochastic element there at the top of you might feel like doing 190 for a set of 8. Is that a robust hypertrophic stimulus at that point? Probably not. Then as you become more advanced, there need to be pretty clear elevations and stimulus for you to get the most out of it. Your body is now defaulted to conservation mode much more than adaptation mode. Almost anything grows you when you're a beginner. There, so long as reasonably overloading, things have to be pretty clearly overloading to guarantee you progress when you're advanced. So you would have to come in and say, you know, I did 200 for 10 kilos last week. Today I will do 202.5 for 10. I have to. You end up doing it and you end up realizing afterwards, like, wow, I didn't even know I could do that. If I just went by feel, I would do 190 for a set of 8, but that wouldn't be a great workout. It could actually fall into that middle zone between what is maintenance and what is adaptive, and you're just sort of generating a high level of fatigue to maintain. So I think it's very important to understand that in the long term, and especially for beginners and intermediates, the progressive overload is applied in an R-regulated fashion for the most part. But there are times and situations, especially if you become more advanced, that you have to remember the progressive overload has to be applied and use that to guide your training to push yourself into very uncomfortable situations in which the ability to detect auto-regulated features is very degraded. Like, especially like a set of 25 reps. Can you do another rep? Probably. How much willpower are you willing to put into it? Another example is during a fat loss phase. It may very well be that willpower effort of knowing you should increase a little that keeps you putting out the loads that you need. And if you just defaulted to auto-regulation, you could get progressively weaker during a fat loss phase, and that would in the end result in muscle, right? So it's almost the same thing as sticking to a diet versus entirely auto-regulating your adjustments based on body weight. Like, if you are having a week where you just eat whatever and then you have that baseline of calories and you lower it next week if you gain weight, as you eat cookies and cookies and pizza, it may occur to you that, you know, I know this is not going to result in weight loss. I know next week I'm going to have to reduce anyway. Why don't I just stop being stupid and apply progressive overload and diet, so to speak, now, and cut my calories to a normal level now, what's expected, and the next week again what's expected, because auto-regulation is almost always a feedback loop, so it takes time. If you pre-program, you can mirror progressive overload without having to default yet to auto-regulation. In the end, both approaches have their merit, and completely getting rid of one or the other is, I don't think, wise. So when people say auto-regulation should entirely take care of progressive overload, they're not, I don't think, completely correct. And when other people say, like, it's just about programming and you just have to do what it takes, they're ignoring auto-regulation, which is a really, really big deal. And the last thing to address the specific example you brought up, we do not at RP recommend adding sets as a matter of pre-programmed elevation. We have an algorithm called the set progression algorithm. It's available on our website in the Hypertrophy Hub. And it is an auto-regulatory formula by which you can progress in sets by pure auto-regulation. And I think that's a very good idea to use. So when we add sets, it's because the last workout we did not deem sufficiently stimulative to maximally get the best adaptations. For example, you start with 3 sets of squats in your first week. That could give you plenty of soreness, great pump, tons of, you know, perceived mind-muscle connection, tension, etc., metabolites. And then those same 3 sets 2 weeks later can be like a real easy workout. Just your work capacity has gone up. You've become more technically proficient at the exercise. And there's adaptation to the exercise itself. You're just more used to it. And someone could say, hey, why aren't you doing 5 sets? And you would say, well, 3 is enough. 3 is enough. And you would say, where in a study has 3 sets beat 5 sets in a training protocol? You'd be like, well, it hasn't. 5 sets is probably more hypertrophic. And you're like, oh, no, I get it. 5 sets would be too damaging. You don't want to go overboard. You're like, no, it wouldn't. I'm actually very well adapted and ready to do at least 4 sets. And then they would be like, so why aren't you doing 4 or 5 sets? You'd be like, I don't know. I was told not to increase my sets, right? So you don't increase your sets. It's not like you're doing 7 sets and you're like, I'm going to die. And the next week you're like, fuck, I got to do 8. No, but you do 7 sets and you're like, I'm going to die. Keep it at 7 or even reduce it to 6. And the next week at 6, you're like, oh, this was great. Keep it at 6. Next week, 6 is like pretty good, but a little easy. And it's your last week coming up before deload. Go back up to 7, right? But if you have 3 or 4 more weeks, stay at 6. And then when 6 becomes really easy and you just do success and you're like, man, I barely got a pump. I barely got sore after, like, I could do more, right? And it's been shown pretty reliably that up to 8 sets on average and probably up to 10 or 12 sets within a specific session causes more hypertrophy per muscle group. Then, you know, there's nothing stopping you from doing more than at that point, just momentum and dogma, and you should probably do more. So it's almost like, you know, the set equivalent. you know, we assume that a certain number of sets is what we should do. Why? The body changes over time. Same thing happens with load. Can you imagine someone saying the same thing with load that they do for sets? Like, well, I start with 50 kilos, I just do it the whole mesocycle. I'll be like, why don't you add some weight? Like, nah, don't do that. It's just disruptive to the system. It's unpredictable. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you're intentionally training way too easy every session, and easier and easier and easier as the sessions go on. Like, yeah. How do you defend that? You don't.
Yeah. I think you mentioned some really good points. I think that was brilliant. And yeah, I agree for the most part. I think more advanced people who already kind of maximized their level of execution are pretty good with the approach of kind of proactively adding sets for a certain time frame. But for less experienced lifters, I think that's not always like the best way to go, as they are leaving a lot of stimulus on the table, so to speak, when they are performing a working set. I mean, of course, the total amount of stimulus will be hugely influenced by the amount of sets we do, but we often hear that volume needs to go up over time. And that is, of course, true to a certain extent, but a lot of people will think that will require purely more working sets. Most likely because number of sets are what we currently associate volume with, but what we actually want is a higher stimulus over time, and we could possibly achieve that without adding sets. And what is limiting us in order to make maybe even better adaptations is not the amount of stimulus, but the cost fatigue. So that's why we want like maximum amounts of stimulus per unit of fatigue overall, a better stimulus to fatigue ratio, a concept coined by you. So I think, yeah,
good advice. Yeah, totally. So I think another way of saying what you just phrased, which is absolutely true, is you have to focus on the quality of the exercise before you focus on expanding the quantity. Otherwise, mm-hmm. you're just doing more dog shit. So mm-hmm. like, so this is credited to my colleague, James Hoffman, who on the RP channel, you guys can weekly answer YouTube questions from viewers. He's also a sports scientist and he's a coach, and he does the James Hoffman skeptical eyebrow when people tell him, hey, my back's not growing, or my chest or my lats or whatever are not growing, but I do 30, 40, 50 sets per week. He's always like, and the reason he does that is like, when his clients tell him that before he started training them, he goes, why don't you show me what your bent row looks like? Take a set 2 reps from failure. And like, he can tell the set's like 8 reps from failure and the technique is dog shit. So he's like, let's wait for 40 sets later. And he teaches them how to bent row correctly, or how to bench press correctly, or how to go closer to failure. And then after several sets, 2 or 3, they're like, oh, my back is fucked up. And it's like, ta-da. So now you only have to do 15 sets. And eventually 15 sets isn't enough and you'll have to do more. But for months and months, improving the quality of your sets is like a free ticket to more growth without having a ton of sets. Because also from an efficiency perspective, how much stimulus you get for how much time you spend in the gym, doing a ton of sets is awful. And I've sort of picked this up from James, and I always get skeptical when people say, like, you know, I need 15 sets of quads to have a good quad workout. Because anytime I have trained someone in person and they said, look, I can't get my quads to do good work for me, I have a couple of workouts I do with people, and they're almost all structured like squats first, hack squats first, or leg presses first, and then one of those two movements after, or a compound movement, and sometimes some leg extension or walking lunge stuff. And I focus on improving the quality of each repetition, usually the range of motion. I move their feet around so that it's more quad focused, and I make sure that they're truly giving a very high effort per set. And all of a sudden, after 3 or 4 sets of leg presses, they like literally shaking and they can't use their quads. And they're like, holy fuck, I've never felt this before. Well, looks like you don't need 15 sets. And in my view, if you need any more than about 8 to 10 sets of quad work per session to get a good workout, there is a 2% chance you're weird and 1 in 1,000,000 or whatever, or 2 in 100, and that you really do need more volume per session. But there's a vast majority of cases that they could just improve the quality of their work. And there are tons of people going to gyms that go to failure every time, and they probably have a good result if they backed off. But there's also tons of people that go to the gym and don't get remotely close to failure, or more specifically, just have really crappy technique. Like, I'm sure you've seen this at many gyms. They're like a lat pull down machine. I mean, for the love of God, people will do that like this right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, I need like 20 sets. I'm like, watch this. Stretch and then touch your chest. And after two sets, like, oh my God, I have a lat pump. I didn't even know what that felt like. They're like, ta-da. So a lot of times it just comes down to technique and they're just using machines wrong or using their body wrong. And they're lifting in such a way as to avoid exposing the muscle to the stimulus versus letting it really be like really letting it be exposed to the stimulus. Like in a bench press or in a dumbbell fly, arching your back a little and opening up your chest or using your rib cage and retracting your shoulders, it puts your chest in harm's way. If you cave in around it, it takes it away from harm's way. Yeah, you feel your chest less, but the point is to feel the chest more. I actually have this mini revelation every time I leg press or squat. If I do the correct technique, my quads feel worse. And it's so tempting in the middle of the set to get away from that so that you can still do the reps and be like, I got 15 reps. But you're saving your quads. And I always ask myself, middle of a set, what the fuck am I saving? I literally sat down for this machine to get my quads stimulated. And now I'm shying away from it. So a lot of it is about using exercise techniques that expose the muscle. It's a humbling exercise, but it radically improves your efficiency and effectiveness. Now you don't have to do a million sets anymore.
Definitely. And I think it's not only important to improve your technique, but also to improve, to prevent your technique from breaking down. Because when fatigue occurs during a set, your body will always push yourself in the position which it's strongest. And if your quadriceps fibers fatigue during a set of squats, your body wants to utilize more hip extensions. And yeah, you really got to fight that, stay upright, and yeah, keep the quads the limiting factor.
That's why there's a bit of a difference between the approach to training for hypertrophy versus strength.
Mm-hmm.
In strength, as long as it's a safe technique, you pick the technique that lifts the most weight. In hypertrophy, the technique could look very similar, but you're always in the back of your mind, especially as an advanced athlete, because for beginners, like if they just generally do the movements, they get great results. An intermediate athlete and an advanced athlete, they're going to want to focus on, okay, I'm working hard, and the muscles I'm trying to train are the ones experiencing the hard work. Like a really easy example is skull crushers. As you get close to failure, what happens? Your elbows start to drift out. That lets you press more weight. Congratulations. But it doesn't do much more for your triceps. So there's this battle you end up facing that if you were a powerlifter, you would just do as much as you could. But being that you're for training for hypertrophy, you have to retuck in your elbows every single time and then retuck in it. You're like, oh, I want to just get this weight and press up. And once you realize that I can't press the weight up if my elbows don't flare, flare your elbows because you don't want to kill yourself. Do whatever it takes to get it up. Rack, that is a set to failure. You just write that in zero RIR because you could no longer do it with good technique. And if you want to do weights without good technique, who knows what you're doing at that point? Who knows what you're training? You sure as hell forgot. You know?
Brilliant. Yeah, I think we can summarize that you don't want to throw more working sets on something which is not working properly. So improve that technique, lift with intent of hitting a sufficient relative intensity for the target fibers and not your whole body. So, and of course, adjust exercise if needed. If you don't feel the exercise and it's giving you no feedback, like a decent pump or maybe some soreness, go find something which suits your psychology or anatomy better and roll with, that. If that means you can only maybe split sets between a leg press and leg extensions for quad movements. I mean, that might be okay, but yeah.
A properly executed leg press beats a shitty squat every day of the week.
Agreed. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about the fatigue, because that's what is limiting us most of the time in order to make better adaptations. I mean, every set and repetition induces a stimulus to our muscle fibers and simultaneously also fatigue. We can subdivide fatigue into acute and cumulative fatigue. Acute fatigue is a short-term disruption that leads to a decrement in performance. Cumulative fatigue is basically acute fatigue, which is not resolved between training sessions, and therefore it kind of adds up over time. Most likely happens if you present an overload relatively frequently, and therefore it needs to be managed carefully with proper fatigue management, taking deloads and stuff. But let's focus more on acute fatigue, which is kind of unavoidable during proper training. There we can divide fatigue further into a peripheral and systemic fatigue. Systemic fatigue, kind of a combination of local central nervous system and maybe psychology fatigue. So could you talk us through those different kinds and how they are relevant in the context of hypertrophy training?
I prefer to use the term local fatigue and systemic fatigue, not the term peripheral fatigue. Peripheral fatigue comes from an exercise science analysis and not a hypertrophy-centered analysis.
Mm-hmm.
When we are training a certain muscle, we're not so much interested in that it exists in what is technically the periphery. We're interested in it being locally what is stimulated. Because if you are doing chest press in such a way that you want to grow your chest, you can experience a high level of tricep fatigue, and that would count as peripheral fatigue in that model. But it's not the same thing as local fatigue to the chest, which is what we want. So we would actually split fatigue into several categories. The big ones is local fatigue of the local musculature itself. And then systemic fatigue is the nerves that activate that muscle, and brain processes that signal and eventually gets it to the nerves. Cardiorespiratory and all the other factors and all the other organ systems. And of course, in the nervous system is also psychology. And then two interesting points of fatigue that are sort of they can be subdivided out from systemic fatigue is synergist / stabilizer muscle fatigue. Mm-hmm. So when you're doing squats, your lower back gets fatigued. It's not really systemic. It's peripheral, sure. It's not really systemic. It's not local to the target muscle. And then axial fatigue, which is, it seems to be that lifting loads involving your spine is a special kind of fatigue, only in the sense that it is usually less than the local fatigue maximum recoverable volume of your lower body. So like your quads and hamstrings and glutes can usually do more all combined than your spinal cord can erect them to do if you have all of the exercises spinally loading. So we reach a point where it's important to consider that kind of fatigue, because your quads might still have 5 sets per week left in them to get more growth, but your spinal cord axial fatigue might be to its limits. So someone says, just do 5 more sets of squats, that might not be a tenable thing.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's really important to always try to make the local fatigue, so to speak, the limiting factor. And you don't have to end your accumulation phase because you're maybe psychologically so fatigued, or your overall systemic capacities are maxed out. So what might be good strategies to make the local muscles more of a limiting factor? For example, doing a mesocycle?
So the biggest factor is to make sure that you train within your MRV of the local muscle and of your system.
Mm-hmm.
So just doing too much training is the easiest way to get yourself in trouble. If you do too much training, there's no amount of sleep or food that can help you out of it. You're just going to be done. So there's that consideration. Then on top of that, we have the consideration of practicing good, sound recovery strategies and modalities, getting enough sleep, food, relaxation, and so on and so forth. If you do that very consistently, everything gets better and you can just train the local musculature better. From the stimulus to fatigue ratio perspective of the local muscle, one of the biggest factors is exercise selection. You don't want to select exercises that have a very high ratio of fatigue to stimulus. And because local fatigue is also relatively stimulative to an extent, what ends up happening is if those kind of divide out and we're left with the stimulus to fatigue ratio ends up becoming much more of a systemic fatigue to local stimulus ratio. Stimulus fatigue, local stimulus on the top and systemic fatigue on the bottom. And there's a couple ways to measure or proxy systemic fatigue and also local fatigue to some extent that we don't want. And we have at least 3 ways of doing this at RP that I think make some sense. One of them is joint and connective tissue discomfort and pain. So if you choose an exercise that hurts your knees for whatever much pump it gives to your quads, so on and so forth, it's probably a good idea to either alter the technique or choose another exercise, right? Secondly, What is the rating of perceived exertion on that exercise? If there's an exercise that gives you a certain amount of muscle growth, but it takes heaven and earth to do, like deadlifts or rack deadlifts. But like when someone's like, how much muscle are you adding with deadlift? You're like, some, then maybe it's not worth it, right? Or partial squatting is really bad at this. You know, you do like a half squat, you have to use like 250 kilos and someone's like, does that really hit your quads? You're like, no. Does that really mess you up? Yes, it takes a ton of effort. I have to get crazy psyched up for them. And then a more formal way of measuring systemic, so that's like a cause of systemic fatigue. It's a, I guess what you would call a leading indicator of systemic fatigue, how hard something is causes more systemic fatigue. A measurement of systemic fatigue is how much that exercise affects the performance of unused muscles. That's actually a way to measure systemic fatigue of that exercise. So if you do bent over rows for your back, and let's say they're the same stimulus as deadlifts, and afterwards you do tricep extensions, which are not really involved in the bent row, you may be able to get a set of like 20 reps with, 50 kilos on the first set. If you do the same number of sets of deadlifts before tricep extensions, you may only be able to do a set of 15 reps at the 50 kilos or whatever. So you're like, holy shit. Like, in some way, this is something you can perceive as well. Like deadlifts really, really fuck you up. And then you look at the tricep extension machine like, oh my God, I just want to leave the gym. I don't even know why I'm here anymore. I'm so fried. Whereas after bent rows, you're probably not as fried. You could probably still do good work. So just by measuring exercise performance, you can see how much systemic spillover is what we call it there is from any given exercise. And there's nothing wrong with systemic spillover. Some of the best exercises, squats, presses, rows, have a lot of it. But it has to be justified by their degree of stimulus. Right. So if the stimulus is equal, you want to choose exercises that are less fatiguing systemically, because then you could just either do more of them and grow even more for any given unit of fatigue, or you can do the same and just get less fatigue and your accumulation phases can be longer and so on and so forth. So that's the fatigue side. So in essence, you want exercises that all other things being equal hurt your, I'll actually expand this conversation. Exercises and the techniques to do them, because there's different ways to do exercises and some techniques may be more fatiguing than others. Exercises and techniques that give you the least joint and connective tissue discomfort, that take the least effort to do and get a good workout perceptively, and also affect your performance in other exercises that are unrelated to other muscle groups, also the least, right? If you can do that, that's super, super great. A really good example of an exercise that has, I'll get to this. So there's lots of exercises that are low fatiguing, but here's the problem. What about stimulus? Like cable rows on a really crappy machine are not very fatiguing, but they also don't do anything. And you're like, I could do like 15 sets and nothing would happen. Like, you know, sometimes you use a machine that like simply wasn't designed for lifting weights. You're like, this machine sucks. Like it's not hard. It's just, there's no way to make this hard. So we have to look at stimulus, and we have three proxies for stimulus. The first proxy is the mind-muscle connection. And what we call the mind-muscle connection is a little bit different than, I think some people think the mind-muscle connection is just like kinesthetic awareness. Like, I can feel my bicep moving. Well, who gives a shit? It's great. You don't have a nerve block to your bicep. Congratulations. But what we really want out of mind-muscle connection is indicative of hard training, of stimulative training. How do we know that? At heavy loads, we call it a mind-muscle connection if you can perceive a high degree of tension through the muscle. Like, you know that feeling in your biceps when you do heavy curls that you almost feel them ripping apart? You're like, ooh, like, holy crap. Someone's like, do you feel that in your biceps? You're like, dude, what are you talking about? Like, I only feel my biceps. And then if it's high repetitions, it's not enough tension or not enough load to produce that kind of perception of tension. In high repetitions, when you get closer to failure, you have a lot of metabolites in the target muscle. So if you're doing curls, when someone's like, man, is that really blasting your biceps for sets of 20? You're like, honestly, I've got all my forearms are cramped and super pumped. I don't feel a shit in my biceps. And then, that's not great, right? Yeah. And then for moderate reps, it's sort of some combination of tension and metabolite burn. So if your target muscle is perceiving a high tension, real good, probably a good stimulus. If it's perceiving a metabolite burn at high reps, probably a really, really good stimulus. The next one is pump. And that happens after set after set after set. And none of these are mandatory, but all three of them together start to paint a good picture because there's three. So a pump, you might not get a pump for much training, but like if you get a pump from something, probably means, first of all, the right muscle is being targeted. Like someone shows you a press for your front delts, but your triceps get pumped and your front delts don't. Someone's gonna be like, great front delt training. You're like, I think it's actually just tricep training at this point, right? And they say, well, can you imagine someone says, well, the pump doesn't mean anything. They're like, so my triceps are getting gnarly pump and you're saying they're not going to grow from this. Like, nah, like that's ridiculous. Right? Mm-hmm. Of course they are. The pump has been shown to be a causative mechanism of growth as well as correlated to metabolite sequestration, which is another causative mechanism of growth. So if you have a big pump from something in a few sets, that's great. Like high rep leg press. Well, let's see which boxes we can check for high rep leg press for now. Does it produce a perception of tension in the quads? Holy fuck, like your quads feel like they're tearing at the bottom. Does it cause a metabolite burn? Oh my God, like you're barely like trying not to throw up. Do they give you a pump? Like two or three sets of high rep leg press, you can't even get up out of the machine. You can't bend your leg completely anymore. And then lastly, what you want to see is a detection of local muscle disruption to some extent, which can mean a couple of things. Can you still hear me?
Yes.
Cool.
You're back.
One sort of indicator of muscle disruption is that you essentially feel that the excitation contraction coupling of the muscle is off. Your muscles feel like something is wrong after multiple sets. Like your bicep just doesn't, you know, like you've done a ton of bicep curls and someone's like, how are your biceps? You're like, I don't know, man. Something happened to them, right? And that also should come with weakness locally to the muscle relative to the rest of your body. Like if you did a bunch of quad work and then you hit a leg extension PR afterwards, but your glutes were tired. Whatever you called quad work probably wasn't quad work. Did I go into robot mode there at all?
I heard you.
Okay, super. Because my stuff is okay. So basically, you want that local muscle, that target muscle, to experience basically a perception of disruption has occurred to it. It's not working properly. Sometimes there could be motor coordination issues. Like if you are stepping down off of steps after a quad workout, you're going to be like, oh, whoa, whoa. Like my quads feel weird. They're tough to control. Like if that doesn't happen, can you have gotten a good quad workout? Sure, but it's not as likely, right? And then you're also looking for indices of direct damage, which isn't to say the damage causes growth, but it sure as hell is correlated with it up until a point where it's too much, right? Like if your quads feel like they got fucked up, if anything, the exercise was too stimulative, right? But it certainly wasn't not stimulative enough, right? If someone's saying like, my chest gets sore all the time when I train, there's no retort in which someone can say like, well, you're not training hard enough. Like, no. Maybe you're training too hard, but you're certainly, something's going on, right? So we have the situation of perception of disruption to the muscle psychologically and movement-wise, reduction in ability, use it including weakness, and then varying degrees of soreness all the way out to delayed onset muscle soreness. So people think like, you know, we used to say delayed onset muscle soreness, but we made this index a bit more, or this proxy a bit more complicated, a bit more nuanced. So now what we say is it's called muscle disruption. It doesn't have to be sore, but I'll put you this way. So when you're training your biceps, do they have to have delayed onset muscle soreness for you to know that you're growing? Absolutely not. But if you can leave every bicep workout and you're like, they feel great, it's very unlikely that you're getting your highest level of hypertrophy out of it. Like, because if that was the case, if you could get a great hypertrophic stimulus without seeing any disruption, holy fuck, you could train your biceps twice as often and get double the, you know what I mean? Like, you would be at the easiest gains in the world. So basically, we have that three-part checklist of mind-muscle connection, either tension or burn or somewhere in between. We have the pump and we have muscle disruption. That's our stimulus proxy. You don't have to have any one of them, but multiple checklists for those are good, and the more you have, the better. So you want to pick exercises and techniques that get you as much of those three things as you can with as little of those three fatigue things as you can. Joint connective tissue disruption, rating of perceived exertion, and decrease in performance for the other muscle groups. A really good illustration, I have two exercises to illustrate sort of two sides of the stimulus to fatigue ratio, right? A low stimulus to fatigue ratio is trying to train your quads with a sumo wide stance partial squat with a rounded back. It fucking hurts all of your joints. The rating of perceived exertion is crazy. And it reduces your ability to perform every exercise because you're completely spent afterwards psyching up for that thing and blowing it up. And then on the stimulus side, it doesn't, you don't really feel much tension in your quads. It's mostly in your hips and your glutes. And then, you know, you don't really get a pump in your quads. And then muscle disruption wise, the quads just don't get a lot. So your stimulus to fatigue ratio sucks. Take another exercise that is an example of a good stimulus to fatigue ratio, in my experience, and maybe not everyone agrees because there's a lot of individual implication here. One of these could be the deficit push-up. I don't know if you've ever done a deficit push-up, like a stretch push-up.
Not yet.
So you just basically do a push-up, like sometimes loaded with weight, sometimes not. You do it and you push up, but you put your hands on blocks so you can go like 5 centimeters lower than normal. Okay.
Yeah, sure.
So what that ends up doing is it's a huge perception of tension to the pecs. You get a gnarly pump from it. You get way disrupted in your pecs and probably even sore. And then it's feels great on your joints for most people. It's really just not that hard to do because push-ups just don't seem to be that hard. And it doesn't really reduce your ability to do any exercises after for muscle groups that weren't involved. It's a very high stimulus to fatigue ratio exercise. So what you want to do, all the exercises you pick for training, you want to go with the higher stimulus to fatigue ratio exercises. And whatever techniques you do, you want to alter them so that the target muscles receive the most stimulus and the exercise as a whole causes the least amount of fatigue.
Hey. That was really, really good. I think, people a lot away from that, just going through that checklist and, hitting all the boxes. And I want, just quickly to touch on the acute fatigue, which is kind of unavoidable doing, some working sets. And my observation is that often scared about performance drop-offs from set to set. Sometimes clients, they could not maintain the numbers of repetitions from previous sets with kind of negative connotations. But what I think is that training is supposed to stimulate and fatigue the local musculature, and therefore it's normal to see a performance decline during a session. And last year I asked Hoffman and you in which way performance from set to set could be either beneficial or harmful during the weekly RP Plus webinar. And you two gave me a brilliant in-depth answer, which surprised me to a certain extent during that time, because intuitively one would think three sets of 10 are much superior to maybe a sets of 10 and 6 due to overall higher tonnage. But what are potential benefits of performance drop off a little from set to set via decreased to wear?
Can you repeat the very last part of your question?
What are potential benefits of letting your performance drop off a little from set to set via decreased numbers of reps?
Yeah, so I'd say the biggest benefit is a saving of time and just doing more sets. So first of all, they've compared programs with different amounts of tonnage, and they realized that the number of hard sets that you do, provided you're sufficiently well rested between them, is predictive of hypertrophy, but the total tonnage isn't. So if you focus on total tonnage too much, you're actually focusing on a variable that's not very clear is super predictive of hypertrophy results. So automatically, you might be chasing something that's not the greatest thing in the world to chase. Secondly, you might have to rest 5 minutes between sets for them to turn out to be 10, 10, 10. To get 10, 8, 6, you might have to rest only 2 minutes between sets. And then probably you'll get a little bit less hypertrophy from the 10, 8, 6. Just a bit less. But it's 2 minutes rest between sets, so we can say that maybe that whole thing took you 6 minutes, whereas the 5 minutes between sets thing took you like 15, okay? If you do four sets and get another set of five or six, you'll have the same hypertrophy as you did from the three sets where you rested longer, but you'll be done with that in like 8 minutes versus 15 minutes for the three sets in which you rested a really long time. So what we say is that as long as your next set isn't systemically limited, that means your cardiorespiratory system is a limiting factor, your central nervous system is a limiting factor, other synergist muscles and stabilizers are not a limiting factor, as long as the local muscle is limited, and as long as you do at least five repetitions per set, you're probably getting a set that's not as hypertrophic as it could be if you rested longer, but pretty close, and is so worth the time that you can just do more sets and get out of the gym faster with more hypertrophy in the tank. Because I think some people get away from seeing training as I'm dosing it to be hypertrophically stimulative. They see it as I have to do 10. Well, is a set of 9 automatically a bad set? No, there's no reason to believe that that's true. Let's say it's a little worse. Well, then maybe you can just do another set towards the end. Why is that different than resting a really, really long time? So, you know, that's the situation. And in addition to that, I don't think that a huge amount of fatigue or like a set-to-set drop-offs, I may change my position down the road, but we currently just don't know how set-to-set drop-offs predict hypertrophy results in any meaningful sense. And because we know that hard sets are really determinative, and as long as you do, you know, rest enough for the local muscle to be a limiting factor, then you're pretty close to getting a good job anyway. To me, a lot of people perseverate on like, well, okay, so my reps on squats go 20, 15, 12, 10, but on leg presses, they go 20, 18, 16, 14. Like, which one's better? Which was bad? Like, my reps drop off this much. Is that bad? And there's really no answer to that currently. And there's no good reason to think that anything other than if you're systemically limited, it's bad. So I think that people who are worried about set drop-offs, they're really worried about something it's just not clear you should be worried about, if that makes any sense, you know?
Yeah.
It's almost, I'll give you an analogy. I've done a lot of body composition testing, and this occurs as much for quite a bit for males, but it really occurs for females sort of more pronounced, where a female will request to be body fat tested and they test her body fat. It doesn't matter for a class of females, not most females, not all, but a huge minority of females. It doesn't matter what you tell them. They think it's bad, right? Because they have no context at all. So you'll say, hey, you have 15% body fat. They're like, oh my God. You're like, that's at the very bottom end for a healthy woman. And they're like, okay.
I have
like,
body fat.
Right. Like, you're lean. You're very, very lean. You're at the lowest we want athletes to be. And they don't know that. They don't know anything. They didn't know what the number was supposed to mean, but they knew it was going to be bad. I think the same thing happens to men and women, specifically men, with the rep drop off. They'll be like, you know, I can't do 10, 10, 10. I do 10, 8, 7. Like, that's bad, right? And it's like, why do you think that's bad? And they never have any idea. They're like, well, that's supposed to stay the same. They're like, why? You get tired as you go. They're like, but I'm not supposed to get tired. Like, well, if you're not getting tired, like you said, Louise, like, what is it that you're doing in the gym? Like, I could easily match my reps if I started out with 6 RIR, 4 RIR, then 2 RIR. I could match it, but that first set is garbage, and the second set, whatever. And the third set's the only one you're really working hard. So what are you doing, warming up for a long time? I prefer to just get right into it, get really good reps in reserve, same ones every set, and let the reps drop off a little bit. No big deal.
Yeah, that's how I do it as well. After you presented me the four-factor model of rest times, which you promote at RP, and I gave that as well to my clients, and they're doing really well. And oh yeah, they really like it.
Does it make sense to them from an intuitive perspective?
Yeah, it does. I always tell them the four things to check before approaching another working set, and then basically everything makes sense. And I experienced that. I just feel less psychologically fatigued when doing working sets, and because I don't have to grind through many leading reps, so to speak, and I have more or just a higher percentage of effective reps, and that's maybe a pretty good a plus side.
Totally. Yeah. Potentially. Yeah. So the jury's still out on effective reps, but we know that the reps towards the end of a set are probably more effective than the ones at the beginning. We don't know how much more, and it's probably not a ton more, but in a sense, your stimulus to fatigue ratio for sets that are done with fewer reps as you get fatigued might actually be pretty stable or go up a little bit, because the fraction of effective reps goes up relative to the total reps. Like, mean, her first five reps are just sort of lead-in reps, like you said, anyway. Like, why not just get rid of those altogether, rest a little less, and get into it? There's problems with that. Faster fibers take longer to recover, so on and so forth. But I think they're probably mitigated to some extent by the fact that faster fibers are more active towards the later reps anyway. So it's kind of like, you know, I think in the end, it probably washes out, meaning that unless your rep drop-off is crazy high and it's due to systemic factors, I think you're probably absolutely fine having reps drop off by two or three here and there between sets versus necessitating them to be completely the same over and over and over.
Awesome, Mike. Thank you so much today for let you go. No, I know it's your deload, so I want you to experience some sunshine.
Well,
not only talk about hypertrophy training all day, so I'll let you go here.
Thank you so much for having me on the podcast, man. And let me know when it airs.
Just one more thing. Sure. At the end of each episode, we put track to our Spotify. It's called the Hypertrophy Cast playlist on Spotify. And yeah, we want to have a song from you, which you might like to listen to during a hard training session or something.
A song, you say?
Yeah, do you listen to music? Do you?
I'm a robot. I don't. Hold on a sec. I actually will give you an exact song. I want to make sure I get this right. I actually am a big music fan, but only a very particular strange music. But you're in Europe. You'll probably appreciate that more because...
Of course, man. I'm all strange music.
So my song is by an artist whose name is Logic Bomb. And the song is Normalized.
Okay, that's cool. No Church in the Wild from Jay-Z and Kanye West. You might know that. That's pretty cool.
Say that again?
Church in the Wild from Jay-Z and Kanye West.
What about... That's not the same song, I hope.
What do you mean?
Okay, you broke up a little. Can you say that one more time?
Yeah,
what about Jay-Z and Kanye West?
The song is called No Church in the Wild.
Oh.
Yeah, that's the song... to the playlist, so we have your song and my song.
Oh, okay, sweet.
Yeah,
oh,
well,
it's two very different kinds of music.
Hey, I'm looking forward to your song.
Awesome. Let me
I'm
know.
I'm interested in what you're listening to do. Yeah, I will tell you when we meet this year in London. I'm attending the song and seminars. So yeah, you're gonna see it there.
That'll be awesome, man. I can't wait.
Awesome, man.
All right.
Okay, Mike.
I'll talk to you later.
Have a great day. Have a great deload and talk to you soon.
Bye
bye.
Thank you so much. You as well.